Good morning. This is Robert J. Sawyer, and you are listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'll see you in the future.
Good morning, and welcome to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours, episode 148 for January 26, 2021. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hassenfly.
And I'm Pam Bedour.
And we have arrived. I feel so much more ethereal now after getting to the end of Flash Forward from 1999. Robert J. Sawyer, boy, he has a lot of concepts that he wants to bring to this last section, Pam.
Now, that's something that I've always noted about Sawyer's novels is that he always brings in many, 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 many concepts, and this novel is no exception. So, yes, the final part of this novel was pretty busy in terms of the topics that it raises.
So let's take it from this one story, and we'll just expand it to a lot of concepts for us.
Exactly. Now, one of the big questions that I had for you guys as I'm rereading a book I've read before, I was really curious if you guys think it's realistic that people would get organized enough, but also like agree with one another enough globally to replicate the experiment. So there's the question of the first time they replicate the experiment, not too long after the flash forward, but then when they realize that you need a neutrino burst to make the flash forward work, to do it once again. And we have the character Rush, who's Theo's would-be murderer, who says, "Do you think humanity's taste for seeing the future will be sated with one more peek? Of course not. We are ravenous in our desire. Since ancient times, no dream has been more seductive than that of knowing the future." And I thought, huh, I'm not sure I would have come up with that as like humanity's greatest dream. But at the same time, I was like, that's interesting. So I can't decide whether I think it's realistic or not that people would basically agree to replicate these experiments.
So we have kind of a modern micro case study for that. And that's certainly COVID, where we seem to be very divided on how to approach this. The United States certainly under Trump had a different way of approaching it than many of the other countries out there. And then also, you know, who's to blame, and so many conspiracies around that certainly would lead us to a very divided look if we just look maybe recent history. But on the grand scale, if there was an external threat, you know, an asteroid's going to come and knock out the world or something like that, I think that the world would come together very quickly. And we would find some strategy to work together to be able to attack an external threat to all of humanity.
But so, this is certainly not that. This experiment is certainly not that external threat that we have to come together. That's a good metaphor, but this is a science experiment that apparently went wrong, and trying to get the world together to decide whether or not we should commit to this science experiment again, it seems far-fetched. I agree.
Well, I mean, you can imagine the Russians saying, "Hey, this is, you know, how dare you do this to the rest of the world?" Or the Chinese saying, "Look, the West is doing this to us." And maybe they want to do their own experiments, you know, replicating it. We're trying to replicate it. I think that we've hit where there would be some real challenges to being able to do that.
But he does offer the opposite viewpoint. That quote that you read, Pam, I said last week, I am one of those people. I want to know everything. Yeah. I want to know the future. Now, there's a limit to that. I don't want to know, for instance, the date of my demise. I don't want to have that information because that information would certainly change my decision making up until that point. So,
come on, Steve. That's an interesting. Really, there are clocks that will count down based on actuarial tables. Your likely demise.
And I would not look at that.
Why not? I mean, it would. How would that change? Listen, if you knew you only had 10 years or 5 years or 25 years or 50 years or 150 years, what would that change on how you would impact? I mean, there are people who today have some kind of disease, cancer, something. Their days are numbered, and they have to make decisions on how to live their final days. Is it going to be going through therapy, or is it going to be go and live?
And my thought on that is live as if it were the last day every day. I do the thing that I want to do. I teach my children, and hopefully
every night
I teach
my
students.
Last meal.
Well, there is a problem with my theory. Yes, you're right. There is an extra food element to this theory that I have. You're absolutely right. But I've taught my children that the last thing you should say to everybody that you love when you leave them is "I love you." That should be the last three words that you say to everybody, just in case you don't see them again. Because you don't want to end on any other note. I think that that is one of the ideas that I live upon, is I want the last thing that I did to be as awesome as all of the other things. And I don't want regrets.
I think you just hit there this idea of just being incredibly humble and kind. Certainly can help out quite a bit.
So one thing I wonder, though, bringing this back to more global, because I think, like, personally, sure, that's great. But I have to say that, like, globally, I don't think the last thing the ambassadors of some countries say to ambassadors of other countries is "I love you." And so I think there's globally, it's a little bit harder to picture people working together with so much consonance between their goals. And even though this novel isn't really about environmental challenges, it's not really overtly about climate change, I think that's the obvious question that comes to mind when we think, to what degree can we all work together? And it's funny, Chip, you brought up the example of an asteroid, which is very, very different than a very slow-moving climate change challenge that we face right now. And it's a huge question. It's a really open question. So I just started reading a nonfiction book this morning called The Environmental Optimist. So I'll let you know what kind of arguments are in that book, because I want to be really optimistic about the environment, but I struggle to imagine how everybody really does work together, because that's one of these quote unquote wicked problems that actually needs buy-in from really all of the countries of the world, in the same way that determining, hey, let's try and have another flash forward, let's get everybody laying down at this time so that we don't have the kind of disasters we did when we did it for the first time by accident. It's a tricky problem.
I just started a book called Everyday Ubuntu, which is about how we are all connected and how we should all care about everybody in our culture all the time. So
in our culture or globally?
Global culture.
That's what
the world.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
Everybody in every culture, that's the key, is connected.
So this reading thing, I've just become aware of it. What is it?
Start a book club, Chip. Welcome to episode 148 of Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. The book club you've always wanted to be a part of.
That's right. As we solve humanity's issues. One book at a time.
I think it's interesting that partway through the novel, we get this sort of firm feeling that this novel is going with a fate is mutable approach to time travel or to future vision. So people can change the future from what they saw in their visions. Now, do you guys think that the visions overall were positive or negative? Is there a way for us to draw upon the affordances of the visions, even though we can't actually like create a flash forward? Does it sort of teach us something? And I'm thinking now about how when we talked to Robert J. Sawyer, he said he had this idea for this novel really, really specifically and clearly at his high school reunion. When he thought, wow, like if people could get just a glimpse of 20 years in the future, it would really help them to live more satisfying lives.
I think humans in general have a difficult time foreseeing a long future. We, mm-hmm. When we're young, we underestimate how close that future is. And then when we're older, we just recognize how short our time is. Yeah. And it certainly changes how you approach the world. I mean, it's when you're young, you're careless. You can be careless, excuse me. You certainly can take a lot. You take a lot more risk than maybe later on. Later on in life, you're calculated in your risk. And also you are very comfortable with certain types of risks. Like, I'll go do this. And if I don't do it, then I miss out on my opportunity. Because, yeah, you have 100 years. And when that 100 years is up, if you're still around, I mean, even that time is going to be short. This is a great puzzle to mentally play out as you're driving, you're commuting or anything like that. If you knew what the world would be like 20 years, what would you do that would be different than what you're doing right now?
It's very deep, this science fiction novel. The question of whether the visions were overall positive or negative, I don't know the answer to that. Because we certainly see Robert J. Sawyer gives us a very good blanket of these are the possibilities. We have sad stories and joyous stories, and we have everything in between. The idea of, I'm so glad that we read A Christmas Carol in December, the idea of seeing your future, and because you see a vision of your future, you can make choices and you can change that future. It's pretty interesting that.
And I like that they call it the Ebenezer effect in Flash Forward. This, like, seeing that quick glimpse of a future 21 years in the future actually helps you to think, whoa, I don't want to be that person, or I can change some things about my life.
And of course, we have this murder mystery where Theo is really trying to find out who murdered him. And in true sci-fi fashion, the murder is going to occur because of the flash forward, of course.
So yes, so the murder wouldn't have occurred without the flash forward, which did occur, so therefore the murder attempts. Now, I think the Theo story is a really fascinating one. First of all, obviously it's a bit of a coincidence that the first person to prove that the future is not immutable is Theo's brother, the brother of the guy who does the flash forward, but whatever.
How convenient.
Exactly. But this notion that some people who didn't like their future want to prove that the future isn't immutable, and they do so by committing suicide. And of course, the very fact that they commit suicide proves that they didn't have to commit suicide to avoid their future, right? So there's like this very, very poignant, very sad insight in that. With Theo, there's also the fact that, I mean, no offense, Theo, but he kind of wastes 21 years of his life worrying about his murder. And he doesn't really, he's so obsessed with the murder that he doesn't live his life. He doesn't pursue Machiko, for example. He doesn't pursue things that he really cares about beyond his scientific work and trying to solve his murder before it occurs.
I wanted to address the part where, if you knew your fate, humans by nature, the way their minds work, if you knew you were being watched, if you knew you were, you're basically going through a maze and you're being forced to go through it, if you knew the future's going to be, you're going to fight that. People, this is sort of the free will, that they're going to fight to have this idea that you know, you're not being controlled or whatever it is.
Did you just write The Matrix?
Exactly, Mr. Anderson.
That idea of fighting, yeah, the idea that if this is all a game, if this is all some sort of science experiment, some sort of illusion, that humanity would want to fight that. That's a very interesting position, Mr. Hessenflow.
Now, one of the things that I really, really enjoyed about this novel, outside of these very complicated philosophical questions that we've just been sort of pursuing here, are the predictions. And so, which predictions did you guys notice? Which did you like? Which did you think were cool? Which did you think were crazy?
the focus on the Higgs boson was the first thing that I saw in Sawyer's writing here. He was writing a book for the idea of this Large Hadron Collider. It was big news at the time in the science community. The finding of the Higgs boson, the solving of the problem of how things have mass is on his mind while he's writing. And he says that they find that in 2009. In real life, we actually did the science and found the Higgs boson in 2012. So he was only off by 3 years.
Now, which is pretty impressive.
it's very scientifically impressive that he would make that choice of how much time he thought it would take to find that solution to that question. But the question that's posed is, was that the most important physics discovery of the 21st century? It seems at this point, very early in the 21st century, that that is the most important discovery. But what could the science lead to? What's the next Sawyer book that he can take that idea of what we have today and analyze it and think about the future of that science? That was my favorite science-y part.
Uh-huh. I like that too. Now, one of the things, and we talked about this briefly last time, is that he thought that the ozone layer would still be a big problem in 2030. And I find it really cheering to think that it's not. I mean, we have many, many other problems, but we did work together as a global community to really solve that environmental problem. So that's really exciting. The idea that fossil fuel cars were outlawed in 2021, yeah, that's not going to happen.
It's pretty close. We're getting there.
Was it Volvo 2024? Maybe Volkswagens, like right around that time. There's a lot of manufacturers who are at least claiming initially that they're going to be abandoning fossil fuel engines. Whether that actually takes place, well, I mean, that's still up to debate because cars are incredibly efficient right now.
But the intention is there at least.
And exactly, here's my not so optimistic feeling about that. I feel like in 2000, we were like, we're going to reduce our carbon emissions and have no fossil fuels by 2020. And now that it's 2020, we have the exact same timeline. Don't worry, we just signed these new accords. We're going to reduce our carbon emissions and have no fossil fuels by 2040. We keep just pushing the time frame out further.
But that will be forever, though, because we have done so much. Imagine what the difference of going from incandescent light bulbs to LED light bulbs has done across the nation. Done to your home, you have more light available. We're sipping electricity compared to what we were doing. We are becoming significantly more efficient, and the population has continued to go up. Mm-hmm. So the point is, this is going to continue to be a fight throughout our lifetime, and we will continue to find opportunities to become more efficient. Where ultimately it crosses line, I don't know, but I can say that I don't think I want to take away light from everybody. I don't want to take away the comforts of life away from everyone because of something that you know could happen 20 years from now, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, humans will continue to react and solve the issues of the time.
My favorite predictions are all about the technology. We see in Sawyer's vision of the future that voice recognition is finally able to do punctuation. This is the biggest innovation in human history. If I could talk into my phone and it could do punctuation correctly, I would be a much better writer today.
Google Voice is not around at that point, is it? Right?
It's getting there. It is getting there. They're trying the punctuation. I've seen a couple of times where it has added punctuation to my voice, and I'm like, all right, we're getting there. Couple more years, and we'll be there. The other thing is the AI in the car. If I get into my car, and my car asks me music or news, I'm like, oh, this is the future I've been waiting for.
Because that's very close to that. Absolutely. And driverless cars, too. The predictions on that are very, very accurate by 2030, for sure.
Isn't it amazing? Certainly, we are living in a Jetsons world, even though we don't live in a Jetsons world.
The push-button age is here for sure in so many ways. This is the future. There's just a couple more tweaks that I need the AI to fix. That's all.
One thing I thought was interesting, this was a little throwaway, but when Lloyd and Machiko are getting married, he mentions that most women still do take their husband's last name in the future. And in fact, I looked it up because it's so funny for me because I'm a university professor. I mean, it would have never occurred to me to change my last name when I got married. I publish under the name I've had my whole life. I just wouldn't have even thought about it. And that's true of many, many of the women I know best. But in fact, 70% of American women in 2020 did take the last name of their husband, which I was very surprised to hear. So that was another accurate prediction.
Certainly, young people have a different approach to life than generations. I anticipate that becoming more likely as the years go by. I mean, who knows?
I think that what Pam has done is point out that she is Pam Bedore. She always will be, and changing her name wouldn't have made sense to her professional life. And as more people see their brand, their name, as important, I think that the idea of forming a family unit by giving the name, I think that is immaterial to the idea of the formation of the family unit.
Well, you know, I have a stage name, a performing name, and then I have my regular name, Steve.
Yes. And we don't talk about your stage work because it's very embarrassing.
Now, guys, what about the Dyson Sphere? What did you think about
love it.
Prediction?
Out there as far as, like, first of all, for your mind to really wrap your around what he's talking about. Basically something that's building around part of the sun. It's just such on a massive scale. It's even hard to even conceptualize how big that would have to be.
The idea of the Dyson Sphere is brilliant. I love the metaphor here for humanity is going to go forward. Humanity is going to achieve this gigantic, enormous, virtually impossible goal of building a metal shell around a star and having a planetary existence on the inside of this sphere so that you could power your society. It's enormous. Yes, you're right. It's ridiculous to think. But at the same time, we have a lot of interesting, innovative ideas that could lead us down this path. In this end of this story, we see that Lloyd gets this immortality. He reaches this singularity where his consciousness is separate from his body, and he's able to travel throughout the universe and see what humans have done in the far, far, far distant future instead of just the 21-year jump. The flash forward is beyond any human capability, but yet humans are still a part of it. This is a great message that Sawyer gives us.
And I find the ending of this novel really fascinating because it takes a bit of a turn, right? So you start out, there's like a big disaster. So you kind of in that sci-fi disaster moment in the first part of the novel. And then you've got a lot of detective work with Theo trying to solve his own murder all the way through. And you've got science fiction all the way through. But then the end kind of draws more deeply on utopian themes. And it's kind of a sort of interesting generic blend, which is something that Sawyer talked with us about when he was here. And definitely I agree with his reading of this novel.
And it's heavily influenced by The Time Machine, the H.G. Wells idea of time travel, where he goes to the very distant future to check out, to see what humanity is doing. And I see Sawyer definitely being influenced by that story.
Which he mentions, sure. Which Lloyd Simcoe mentions in the text.
And Sawyer obviously is a great big idea man. or a dia person. He's a person who certainly grabs something and then just goes with it a little bit, because it really is. We start out with this story where it's about an event that happens, how it impacts some people, and then we go to this, like, this last part. We have these great big ideas, these sweeping ideas that are just so much grander than the story.
Right. So the two big ideas that we have at the end are the notion of human immortality and all of the ethical questions around that. So Lloyd is offered this immortality treatment, but his wife isn't, because she doesn't have the same quote unquote contributions to make as he does. So she's not chosen. So what is that?
So that's certainly there's a puzzle right there. And that's the one, once again, as you're driving on the highway to work or whatever you're doing, to sit around and contemplate, Lloyd is offered immortality. His wife is not. And the justification was, listen, we don't have the technology to do everybody. We're picking this elite group of people. And your wife, unfortunately, is not one of them. But you'll have 20 good years left with her. But at that point, you have immortality. Mm-hmm. And if you don't choose this, you get to take the other pill and you'll wake up and you won't remember any of this, right? You get to drink this serum and he won't remember the offer that's being made.
Yes, but, Mr. Hessenflow.
Exactly. Mobius right there. Yes. But really, I mean, that's a true... that's a puzzle. I mean, this is the person that you love. And I'm sorry, I'm going to bring up once again, the guy who is making the offer justifies it again. Hey, listen, this is your second marriage and her second marriage too. This is about experiences, not maybe eternal love. Yeah, certainly, once again, just taking a blow right to this relationship. Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on in this little interaction that I think that is just nice brain work to kind of work out and play around with you in your mind and see if you would come up with the same conclusions.
And really good science fiction, right? Because the ideas here are so many different concepts of what science can do and what our future looks like based on today's science. The idea of the singularity, which we've expressed so many times now, is the idea that your consciousness could be digitized. We could take the zeros and ones, the electrical impulses that make up you, and we could, theoretically, put them into a powerful enough computer that you could theoretically live forever. And it's just in there. It's just and by the way, he lives forever.
And there was a religious influence of this too, because the person making the offer said, hey, listen, I'm a Christian and I'm not looking forward to my eventual demise because I know what's going to happen to me. But there's no doubt that your wife will go to her heaven or her the better place. Mm-hmm. Certainly, place. Once again, just there's this beautiful onion that you continue to peel back on this offer and just say, well, what do you want to do?
Right. And then the other giant issue that's brought up at the end alongside the immortality question is that as Lloyd goes 800,000 years into the future or something like that, that's what it is in H.G. Wells' time machine, he finds out that humans are alone in the cosmos. There's no one else.
That aren't we always paradox.
Alone? Aren't we always alone?
That Fermi paradox, very interesting that we get back to Fermi here after talking to our local physicist from the Fermi lab here in Illinois.
Fermi,
Mr. Freeze
nice
himself.
To see you.
The Fermi paradox that we are this sentient group of humanity here on this planet. And the vastness of the universe, we've never seen any other sentience, no sign of it. And that's a paradox that science has been playing with for a very long time, and that Sawyer says maybe this is it. Maybe we are the only ones. Wow.
We're finding life everywhere. I mean, whether it is has consciousness, like humans, that we don't know, but there we are finding life and plenty of. I mean, they found life on Mars, and they've found it on whatever moon it is. I can't remember if it's Saturn or whatever. So we're starting to get, you know, at least we're finding bacteria and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we've only been looking for a super short time.
Right.
But,
right.
I mean, that's Carl Sagan versus Fermi. So now I found it very interesting that Sawyer went out to these big, 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 big topics and actually gave us the references like Dickens for some of the morality questions, like H.G. Wells for some of the science questions. And then he brings it all back in to a really, really small, tight closing. So let's look at the ending of this novel, my friends, as you know I like to do. So we end with Theo finally saying, oh my gosh, I've like not wasted, but spent 21 years of my life trying to prevent my own murder. Maybe I should tell Machiko, who I've been in love with for half of my life, that I am like available. But he doesn't come right out. But he invites her. He says that he's been invited to give a lecture in Tokyo. And should they hang out? She wasn't looking for an out. I'd love to see you again, Theo. Of course, there was no way to tell whether anything would happen between them. She might just be looking for a bit of nostalgia, remembering things past, the times they'd had at CERN all those years ago. But maybe, just maybe, they were on the same wavelength. Maybe things would work out between them. Maybe after all these years, it was going to happen. He certainly hoped so, but only time would tell. The end.
No way to tell. The whole book is about seeing the future, about knowing, about knowledge, about, my goodness, going out into the universe thousands and thousands of years from now to have knowledge. And he ends with, there was no way to tell.
So I'm going to just say it. And there's an industry that maybe I'm affiliated with that uses the terms past performance is not indicative of future returns.
Uh-huh.
And so that point being is you can have all this knowledge, you can have all the database, but until the future reveals itself, you ultimately do not know it. And all you can do is control what you can control and taking the actions that you can do, which you're in control of, may give you the opportunity to achieve the things that you value. They can certainly increase it, especially if you focus your energy on things that are really important to you and let the other things that don't matter as much just kind of go to the side where they should belong. So he can control his interaction with her. What that ultimately leads to, no one knows. What I think that is, you know, the great human experience is that we have this beautiful mind that allows us to take incredibly complex stimuli and then ultimately we have to take action on it, and we don't know what's going to happen. We can hope for the best and maybe we can achieve, you know, the things that will make us happy or improve our situation or any number of other things.
That's a pretty good magic trick that Sawyer has done here, that he has written a text that the utopia dystopia expert enjoys, that the sci-fi 50s Klaatu Barata Nictu type reader enjoys, and the financial guy likes. How about that?
Pretty good.
There's talent right there.
But the one thing that I have to say is the action movie that broke out in the middle of my sci-fi novel, I skipped through. My brain was not ready for the hover car chase through CERN. I was like, yeah, okay, there's a bomb, there's a timer, and then we're chasing each other on hover cars. And it reminded me of some of the really bad sci-fi movies that I've watched in my lifetime, like Space Mutiny, where they have this hover car chase. I was like, okay, I can skip that section.
But it's interesting, because without the flash forward, Theo wouldn't have had any clue what was going on, and he wouldn't have been able to protect himself. But also without the flash forward, Rush would have had no reason to kill him. So mm-hmm. there's a sort of, again, there's a little bit of that paradox that happens there. And I think this is just one more way that Sawyer really loves to draw together a bunch of different genres. And I had forgotten when I was listing, is it science fiction, catastrophe, time travel, detective? You're right. There's this big action sequence near the end that's also pretty interesting.
I disagree. It was not interesting.
So, Steve, would this make a great Rick and Morty episode?
I think that the concept of Rick and Morty being the crude is the nicest word that I have for it. The crude Back to the Future, where the scientist who created time travel is not as capable as he might seem, but at the same time, he is brilliant. I think that the concept is there, but I think that's because Sawyer put in every sci-fi concept available.
Sure.
And interesting view of humanity. I see how when we talked to him, his focus was on the humans. What does a human in 1999 see, and how are they evolving toward their future? And boy, did he write that well in this.
And I do really like the ending of this novel. I think that it is really powerful to bring it back down to a single situation. It is nice to end with characters that you've spent a decent amount of time with, instead of ending on like that big idea of immortality or humans alone in the universe, to bring it back to like, do you pursue a love interest that you've had for two decades? Why not? Go for it, Theo. And that's where
so Pam, I see why this is part of your curriculum as far as what you teach other students. I think this is just a wonderful exploration, certainly written from a different time that still is relevant today. So thank you for bringing this to us.
Did you say other students, implying that we are taking this course right now?
Steve, I'm just a simpleton who responds the best I can.
I think we are sitting at the foot of a real reader and a real deep thinker. Pam, thank you so much for bringing us this particular book, and Robert J. Sawyer in general, because like we've said, Robert J. Sawyer is very famous in Canada for his sci-fi writing and unknown here in the United States. So hopefully we have brought his writing to a broader audience here.
Not unknown. I mean, his books do get a decent amount of traffic in the U.S., but it's true, not nearly as well known in the U.S. as in Canada. And so, he's got 24 books. So at some point, very, very different. We might want to read the dinosaur book. We might want to read the AI book. There's lots of different directions, the alternate history book. So lots of different directions we can go. So this is a writer we might come back to at some point.
One of the other philosophical quotes that I pulled out of this book about humanity and about looking into the future and looking back in the past at the same time is, it was nothing like the first time, but what in life ever is. That is a beautiful sentiment about trying to replicate that feeling that you got the first time. It almost never happens. Sequels frequently are not as good as the original.
You mean Jurassic Park 2 was written like a screenplay?
Yeah. There's lots of different ways to get information, and lots of TV shows and movies, and I really encourage everybody to look deeper into things like an author that you've never heard of, like Robert J. Sawyer. I never heard of him, and as an avid sci-fi reader, I think I've missed out on something, and I'm going to have to go back and look at the rest of his work after this.
Well, I've missed out on a whole bunch, Steve, and why don't you set us up with what we're reading next?
Yes. It's my turn once again to bring a book to the book club. Our next book is another science fiction with a lot of humanity to it. Next week, we are starting the first quarter of Blake Crouch's Recursion. Now, this is a 21st century book, Pam. This was written and published in 2019. This is a very young book compared to what we have been reading, and it covers all of those ideas that we've talked about so many times before in the book club. The idea of who are you and what are you going to do about it. This is a fantastic science fiction with a lot of humanity to it. I look forward to hearing your perception of Recursion that we're going to start next week.
I'm really excited about this book. You've mentioned it before, and I'm thrilled to be reading it. It's fun to exchange sci-fi novels, too. So, yay.
So what chapters are we reading?
So this one's broken down into 5 books, and we're going to read the first book for next week. We're then going to read books 2 and 3 combined for the week after, but stick to book 1 for this first week, Recursion by Blake Crouch. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week.
Pam, do we have enough information to venture out into the universe?
We'll do our very best, and I'm really excited to come back next week.
I'm really excited to hear from all of you. Have you been reading along with us? Do you know about Robert J. Sawyer? Is this news to you? Are you now going to go and read more Robert J. Sawyer like I am? We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4867. Our website is sandwichesatirregularhours.com. Our email is sandwichesatirregularhours@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and YouTube. I want to thank you again for listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenblatt.
And I'm Pam Fedora.
See you in the future. If you don't already know what's going to happen in the future, it's very confusing.